From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. Those who try to stop or manage devastating wildland fires spend most of their time trying to adapt the forest using things like controlled burns or cutting down trees. However, a new study says that we should be spending our time and money making homes in these areas harder to burn down. Now, that's a controversial idea for many who don't want to be told what to do with their private property, and it would take political will and new zoning and building codes to make it happen. So here to tell us more is Mountain West News Bureau Boise reporter Murphy Woodhouse. Murphy, always nice to have you on the program.
Good morning, Gemma. I guess afternoon now.
Yeah, afternoon, right? Okay, so this was a white paper out from Headwaters Economics. So to get going, what would you say are some of its core arguments?
Yeah, so the title of it is Redefining the Urban Wildfire Problem in the West. If what we're talking about today is interesting to you, I would certainly encourage folks to go and find that for themselves. But very basically, the authors here make the argument that there are some very deep contradictions at the heart of wildfire policy. You know, today there's lots of talk of the wildfire crisis. I do think that sort of language is appropriate given the sorts of things we're seeing. And I think that there are a number of things that people would point to as elements of that crisis. We, of course, have more and larger fires driven both by climate change and the legacy of decades of suppression-first wildfire policy that led to the buildup of fuels. The many health concerns from wildfire smoke, very famously during the wildfires last year from Canada, you know, the billions spent on wildfire annually. But what the authors point to, and which I think is just a very sensible way to think of as like a core element of what this crisis is the destruction of communities, homes, and neighborhoods. The cases that immediately come to mind, the horrific and tragic fire in Lahaina, the Marshall Fire in Colorado, things like this, entire communities lost in these horrific incidents. So those, alongside, of course, the loss of life that we saw in Lahaina, as well as the Marshall Fire and others, and then, just recently, the fires near Ruidoso, New Mexico, where hundreds of homes, reportedly including, some owned by the firefighters who were battling it themselves, they really point to that as like one of the key elements of this crisis. And I think that that's a pretty consensus, non-controversial take. But what they go on to say is more interesting. So the authors write that, quote, current wildfire management approach has partially inverted the wildfire problem as one in which wildland fires encroach on communities when in actuality it is communities that have increasingly impinged on wildlands where fires might appropriately play an important ecological role. So that's still fairly straightforward, but they argue that this way of conceiving of the problem comes with some very serious implications, and here's what they write about that. Quote, the outcome is that we treat the urban half of that problem as though it were primarily a wildland concern, best handled by eliminating and controlling all fires in the surrounding countryside. Meanwhile, and regardless of the inevitability and ecological realities of wildfire, we treat the wildland portion as if it were an urban fire, best handled by abolishing fire with methods like those used historically to purge fires from cities. And here's the key line. The consequence is cities burning as though they were wildlands and wildlands not burning enough. So that language came from wildfire historian Stephen Pine, who's one of the paper's co-authors, and I think it's pretty safe to say one of the most important fire scholars working today. He graciously gave me a lot of his time to go deeper on this paper and the perspectives that he brought to it. And I mean, for me, I mean, I used to read him on the fire line, and so it was pretty cool to get a chance to speak with someone who has really been a big part of my wildfire education. So let's hear from him about what he says the paper was trying to do.
The problem has been misdefined, and we've diverted our energies away from actually solving the problem.
So Pine, of course, is a historian, and he brought his historical perspectives to the analysis. He pointed out to me that for much of U.S. history, cities burned up frequently with wildfires. So, think probably most famously Chicago, but there are lots of examples. So here's Pine again.
If you define it as an urban fire problem, it's very simple. We know what to do. Our cities used to burn as often as the surrounding countryside. They were made of the same materials and responded to the same weather and droughts and so forth. And we ended that. And so we know what to do to prevent cities from burning. Whether we choose to do it is another issue, but we know what to do.
And so we'll get into that more later. But what happened was, you know, a lot of regulations and rules for how to build, where to build, et cetera.
Okay, so Murphy, that kind of points to the implications for the built environment then. But can you talk a little bit more about the implications for wildlands themselves?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So, I mean, the situation is really a two-way street with impacts going both ways. And so as I understand the argument, that, you know, the authors are basically saying that we're putting too many eggs in the forest treatment basket to protect the built environment. So I do want to be clear that things like prescribed fire and fuel reduction, they really do reduce the likelihood of catastrophic wildfire. The author's point here is that making homes and communities more resilient is far more effective at protecting them. And here's what they write. Quote, wildland fuel treatments are seen as the primary tool to reduce structure loss, despite decades of research demonstrating that the conditions of the structures and their immediate surroundings are largely responsible for loss. But when structure protection is seen as a key priority of fire officials, as it is, it also makes it more difficult to allow fires to burn, makes suppression more likely, and is an obstacle to the important ecological work that fires provide to many ecosystems in the West, and not just in the West, across, I mean, the whole world. And so for that to happen, Pine says that communities really have to be better able to withstand fire. Let's hear from him again.
You've got to protect them so that you're free, you have more public space, if you will, and decision space to begin reintroducing the fires that we need in the surrounding wildlands and countryside, not just for fire protection, but also for all the other ecological goods and services we get out of fire.
And then beyond that, you know, there's the added wrinkle that, you know, while suppression may very well protect a community today, what we know, you know, from lots of research is that the cumulative effect of decades of heavy suppression policy, that's exactly what has led to the buildup of fuels that can ultimately make future fires even more destructive.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I mean, Murphy, this is interesting, right? But how then do you take all of this and actually move toward making it a reality?
Yes, the necessary reality check. So the lead author on this paper was Kimiko Barrett, who's with Headwaters Economics, and she's a very accomplished wildfire scholar in her own right. And we've had pretty regular conversations since I started here last year. She's just been a wonderful person to go to help wrap my head around the many issues we're facing when it comes to wildland fire. And so she points out that much of wildfire policy falls under the purview of land management agencies. People here in Idaho will, of course, recognize the Forest Service, Department of Interior, BLM, et cetera. But she argues that other federal agencies like Housing and Urban Development, HUD, and the National Fire Administration, also FEMA and others, you know, they have expertise in things like structure firefighting and community resilience and could very much play a bigger role in how we confront the wildfire crisis. And she sketched out, you know, what a federal risk reduction program, you know, what that might look like.
So the entire program would be dedicated to community risk reduction, providing resources, technical assistance, financial incentives and investment, direct pass-throughs to the communities themselves to mitigate risk, including education, training, skill set development of a workforce that could actually do this work. But really, it's this idea of fusing together the multidisciplinary skill set and discourses needed to address the complexity of the wildland-urban interface in a more holistic way.
So in short, there's just a lot of federal expertise that she thinks could really be brought to bear on this enormous problem. But, you know, whatever program is ultimately developed, I mean, here's kind of her overarching point about current efforts. You know, we talk a lot about the wildland-urban interface, but she says, you know, almost all actual investment goes towards the wildland part of that equation. But if the destruction of homes and communities is what we care about, and I think that is what we should be caring about, you know, they really need to come front and center.
Okay, so that's the federal side of things, right, Murphy? So what then does it look like on the local level? Because would it seem that it could just kind of get stickier and murkier?
Yeah, I mean it very much could, and so I mean this is where we're going to be talking about what some people call the R word, regulations, and let's just get right back to Kimmy, who I think puts it pretty well.
regulations, building code, zoning, all of the measures that are out there within the toolbox to actually compel the level of mitigation needed to make a difference, which would be at neighborhood and community scale, does have to come from the local jurisdiction. So that's going to have some obvious pushback, because here in America, we don't like to be told what to do with our own private lands and property.
Yeah, so, you know, she identifies one of the key obstacles for the sort of like sea change that they're trying to propose here. And, you know, I certainly don't have any silver bullet solutions to solve it. Maybe you do. I certainly don't. But Pine also agrees that legislation and enforcement are the ways forward here. And he points to kind of his historical work to bolster his case, you know, saying that that's exactly how the longer standing or the historical problem of you know, major urban conflagrations was solved. I mean, we decided to build differently, but he also acknowledges that that very much represents a fight and probably a fairly ugly one in places like Idaho and other parts of the West. But you know, I think it's also, you know, it's also worth contemplating, like, however undesirable or complex that route forward seems, you know, he paints a quite bleak picture, you know, of carrying on business as usual. You know, he says, I mean, this is more or less a direct quote, you know, it's one of muddling along and hoping that we get sufficient control of climate change to have something to leave future generations. So, you know, however difficult it is to imagine a new way of living with fire, I think it's just worth saying that the way we're currently living with fire is not a very good one.
So, Murphy, there's something that I find very interesting about this when we talk about regulations, right? And the fact that, yes, in particular in places like Idaho, you do not want to be told what to do and with your own property, right? Your own house and et cetera. With that said, you mentioned the fire in Lahaina, which happened last August, August 8th last year. And there is a picture where the entire town is decimated, but there is a house standing intact, a 100-year-old house. It's a white house, red roof, and there is no damage to this house. And people were calling it, you know, the miracle house. Well, then they talk to the owners, and you know what they said. The owner said, "Well, we thought it was a combination of certain things. We used commercial grade corrugated metal roof. This is because they redid the home." There was stone around the house. There was palms around the house that absorbed the heat. They had basically made sure, though, that there was, like, you know, no vegetation all around the home, right? And when fire experts saw this, they said, you know, basically, this is kind of what people should be doing when they live in areas where wildfires can happen. So with that said, when we talk about, you know, regulations and not wanting to potentially do that, there are examples, though, Murphy, of this working. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, many people in the West are, you know, at least hopefully at this point, you know, pretty familiar with a lot of the, you know, the key things that you can do to make your home safe, right? Like, you know, mm-hmm. like you mentioned, different sorts of roofs, protected eaves, significant distance, you know, between the home and any vegetation, non-flammable fencing materials, right? I think a lot of people have a basic idea of what's necessary here. But I do think that, you know, kind of riffing here a little bit, but I feel, you know, basically comfortable doing so. We'll see how it goes. But mm-hmm. like, I think that a lot of this language has really kind of conceived of this as, you know, the individual efforts of individual yeah. homeowners. One, that ignores the fact that many people like myself are renters in the West. We don't actually own the mm-hmm. properties in which we live. I think that that's a very important and separate issue mm-hmm. and very much a social justice issue. But then it's also like, when you have a situation like the Marshall Fire or Lahaina or other incidents like this, the homes themselves actually become the fuel. We're no longer in the wildlands, right? And so, right. you know, even if you have taken many of these measures, when you have multiple homes fully engulfed near yours putting out, you know, massive, massive flame lengths, your preparations might not be up to the task. And so, you know, while, again, like, this has often been conceived of as an individual responsibility and individual mm-hmm. effort, I think that a lot of these recent tragic incidents have really pointed to the very social nature of these disasters, you know, the idea that we owe something to our neighbors and our communities, and that when we don't make these preparations, like we're not just making a decision for ourselves, we're not just taking risks for ourselves, right? We're increasing risk for, you know, the people that we share these spaces with. And then as a former wildland firefighter, I do apologize for playing that card so much, but it's also like when structures are involved, you know, I think that really changes the dynamic of what's going on. It raises the stakes. It raises the temperature. And, my friends and colleagues out there are taking enormous risks, enormous immediate and long-term risks to show up for their community. And I think that the least that people can do to show their appreciation for that extremely dangerous and, I would say, underpaid work is to do what you can, not just as on your own, but as a neighborhood, as a community, together to address this issue. This is not something that we're going to get out of as individuals thinking about our best interest and, you know, after me the flood sort of thinking. This is an us together problem.
Well, and you don't want just one home standing intact.
Exactly. Is that a neighborhood you want to return to, right? I mean, you're talking about all of the toxic stuff left in the ground after the homes are destroyed. I mean, just imagine, you know, a car melts onto the street. Do you want to walk on that street after that happens, right? I mean, that's not a desirable neighborhood, I would say, after the fact.
And you're not exaggerating by saying that as well. So then with that said, Murphy, I mean, you have to, you know, try to make this vision a reality, right? Regulations or no. So are we looking at the next couple of decades, I would think, before we really are going to maybe see significant change? But what might a new relationship with fire end up looking like?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it is good to end on more of like a positive vision, just because, I mean, you know, last year, even though it was like a light season in terms of acreage in the U.S., obviously Canada was a different story. I mean, we had Lahaina, horrific incident, right? We just had the New Mexico blazes. I believe that there were some fatalities there. I'm not entirely sure, but certainly.
I think there were.
Exactly. I mean, like hundreds of homes lost, right? I mean, like this is something that just keeps happening. And so like I you know, and we certainly have what promises to be a quite active season on tap. You know, so I think that just we're going to just keep being presented with the lesson that we are not living with fire well. And sort of in this context, you know, I've become increasingly interested in contemporary and historical examples of more balanced relationships with fire. Certainly a source of that is, the many indigenous peoples in the United States with long traditions of cultural burning, which we've talked about previously. But, you know, whatever the new relationship we want to move toward, you know, I do think it's good to just have like a vision out there, what that could be like, you know, what it might be like when a fire does come to our communities. And I think that Kimiko had a pretty inspiring summary, if we could hear from her.
An aspirational goal would be that we have more beneficial fire on the landscape. We have homes and communities and infrastructure better prepared for that wildfire in the form of building code adoptions, community planning efforts, water security, adaptation and resiliency baked into how they have envisioned growing alongside not just wildfire, but all increasing hazards. And obviously that there is a lot less damage to homes and communities. People's lives are not at risk, and the community is ultimately able to thrive following that wildfire. And the forest is healthier. The community is in a better position than it was even prior to having that fire exist, simply because they have prepared and anticipated its inevitability at this point.
I mean, I don't think I'm going to be alone in saying that sounds a little bit better than what we're doing right now. And, you know, as I think he often does, Pine had a pretty poetic way to kind of put this all together. And so he told me, this is going to be more or less a direct quote, it's not about living with fire, he says. And, you know, we hear that a lot, living with fire, and that almost, you know, sounds like, you know, tolerating it, right? Like, it's this annoying thing that we just have to put up with, and we'd rather not, but it's not a choice. But recognizing that fire is a part of living, right? That it is an essential part of the landscape, and that, you know, if we're going to be living out here, fire is a neighbor. So anyway, I do appreciate being able to kind of wrap things up on a more positive vision.
Yeah. Before I let you go, Murphy, what would you hope is the ultimate takeaway from all of this reporting and research you've been doing?
Man, I don't know. I do appreciate that question, but I mean, I feel a little overwhelmed by it. I mean, I guess like what I would say is that, you know, there's obviously a lot of very troubling things going on with wildfire right now. I think we're likely to see this year even more loss, likely more fatalities. I mean, we're going to just keep seeing these sorts of awful things. But I do think that the lesson that, like, you know, what we're doing now doesn't make sense, and it's time to really kind of go back to the drawing board. And when that happens, what's become increasingly important to me is the idea that whatever way out of this that we find, it's one that we find together, right, democratically, as communities, like not as this, like, you know, how do I, you know, build a wall around my home and survive, the inferno? Like, how does my community survive this? How does my neighborhood survive this? How do we get through this together and get to a place where, you know, fire is, you know, a part of our lives, but not a threat to our lives? You know, something I've been saying recently is, you know, it's like the way I'm increasingly conceiving of the issue is, it's like fire is not the problem itself. Fire is not the danger here, right? The danger is the way that we've chosen to live with fire. There are many historical examples of other ways of living with fire. I think there's a lot of inspiration there. But yeah, I mean, it's like, it is possible to do. We're not doing it well currently, but I really hope that working together and democratically, we can figure out a better way to live with fire.
Well, I really appreciate that sentiment, Murphy. We've been talking with Mountain West News Bureau Boise reporter Murphy Woodhouse about a new study on how to stop devastating wildland fires before they happen. We will, of course, put a link to Murphy's story on our website, boisestatepublicradio.org. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.